Bonjour à tous et à toutes. J'ai des excuses, je vais parler en anglais et je n'ai pas une présentation en PowerPoint, donc c'est une question des oreilles plutôt que des yeux. Et je m'excuse pour ça aussi. Je suis très reconnaissant, bien entendu, des invitations très flatteurs de Capel et de Sanjay de participer dans ce colloque si intéressant et, à mon avis, si important. Cosmologies of Circulation and Enlightenment Agronomy. I'm supposing that historical interest in early modern circulation regimes and their relation with knowledge production comes presumably in part from the aim to break with certain notions of a unique, privileged, central origin for established sciences. And we've seen that in several of the presentations we've already heard. There's a connection between these reorientations of what one might call the historical geography of the sciences and an extremely welcome demand that the range of knowledge and of knowledge producers that our histories should address must be considerably increased. Now, that's an important demand to make, but exceptionally difficult to satisfy. It requires precisely the kind of archival agility that we've just witnessed. Furthermore, the models of circulation which we're interested in will be very significantly inflected when, as we've also heard today, attention is drawn to the many ways in which movement is restricted or blocked or sealed or stamped, in which parasites are ruled out and leaks sealed. And no doubt in my part of the forest, one of the besetting deformations of the historiography of the natural sciences was that it tended to take as the ideal form of science a kind of early modern rational mechanics and its dissemination through print. And it assumed, it seems to me in retrospect, completely bizarrely, that all parties in a circulatory system always wanted and always relied on perfect communication. It's not like that where I work, and I don't think it was true for the famous dead. As both Samir and Filippo pointed out in their talks, respectively in the cases of poison and war, reasons of state and cult and guild and market will always dictate techniques of secrecy and the sequestration of apparently open knowledge systems. Indeed, that sequestration, that clandestinité, as Samir put it, and the closure of secrets were sources of immense amount of knowledge work in early modern Europe. Circulation then required boundaries that could, in this very interesting way, only be defined if they were broken. You only know you have a boundary if you cross it. That's what the word vigipirate means, I've discovered. I initially thought it was a kind of strange form of piracy, but I'm English, what do I know? So circulation needs boundaries which are defined only if and when they're transgressed or crossed. And in the period with which we're concerned, the period of the first modernity, knowledge systems were systematically and simultaneously hermetic and mercurial. And it's extremely significant that the spirit there is both to do with travel, Hermes, and secrecy, Hermes. They were fascinated by the apparent oxymoron of secret communication and its performance. The question of knowledge status, savoir, rather than the more restrictive science, is therefore bound up with circulatory models of what moves and what doesn't, what should move and what should not. What I want to get at in this talk is that these idioms of open and secret knowledge are, of course, this is blindingly obvious, not the sole prerogative of historians. They were the central themes in early modern knowledge practice too, as Professor Ginsberg reminded us many years ago in his work on high and low knowledge. In other words, I want to get at the reflexive dimension of discussions of circulation. I want to think very briefly about the fact that circulation in various languages, I have not looked it up in Sex Linguarum yet, circulation was in several senses a working term of enormous significance in early modern and enlightened cosmologies, and it was put to work simultaneously to make sense of major themes in economy, in cosmology, and in theories and practices of social and natural order. So there ought to be something interesting to say, and this is an experiment on whether that conjecture is true, there ought to be something interesting to say about the relationship between our interest in regimes of circulation and their investments in the idiom and practice of circulation. In, to choose a linguistic example at random, English, for example, which is one of the many reasons I'm speaking in English. The two areas I want to think about are two English colonies, Australia and Highland Scotland. One of them is independent, the other... And in both cases, spectacularly in the case of Enlightenment in Scotland, and clearly in the case of the penal colony the English established in Australia from 1788, the work that circulation does as a concept is part of the work of making knowledge in those places and the work of governing them, well or, as we will see, ill. So to start with, we have to think, what are the pattern knowledges in play at that conjuncture, roughly L'Age des Lumières? It seems to me that there were two sciences which were taken as model in this period, astronomy and agronomy. Astronomy, a mix of precision measures and cosmological models, embodied in Newtonian systems of observatory practice, that perhaps is familiar. Agronomy, involving rational experiments on the management of productive land. Both model sciences made artful use always of the practice and vocabulary of circulation. In astronomy, the language of circulation applied to the planetary system. More, I would say, even in France than Outre-Manche. It applied to, the language of circulation also applied to the sources of knowledge of that system. So Capel's talk, if you missed it, you missed a really great talk about William Jones's Mosaic and Gentile genealogy for language and knowledge, reminds one that part of Jones's project was to write a circulatory history of astronomy, using astronomy as a way of calibrating the movement of languages. It's an extremely good example. Circulation also applied, was applied by the contemporaries themselves to the trading networks that supplied such knowledges and then exploited them. Newton's cosmology of the circulation of activity through the cosmos relied explicitly on data gathered from commercial networks across the planet, and it was supposed to be applied to the security and efficiency of those networks. And, this is part of my point, Newton says so. In other words, Newton reflects on the provenance of his own information using the language of circulation, and then he applies it to the movement of the heavens. He has a name, a very interesting name, for the agents who move in the space between our Earth and the other planets and who know everything. The word he uses is angels, which is the early modern word for ambassador, sidereus nuncius. So there is a reflexivity in Newton between his angelology, which projects into heaven the ideal information order he thinks he is relying on here on Earth. That's a good example of what I'm trying to get at, okay? There's a lot of poetry, which I will spare you, written in 18th century English, which links together the Newtonian worldview and circulation and commerce. The reason I will spare you is because the poems are, with only one exception, rubbish. But under the theme of mercantile and astronomical circulation, the language that connected and compared trade networks with those of planetary movements stayed common throughout the Enlightenment's own reflections on global commerce. Raynal's Histoire des deux Indes is by far the best example of this kind of project. It notoriously linked astronomical science from Newton with the free circulation of commodities and a utopian economy. It described, I quoting from the Scottish edition, the communication of flying bridges, les ponts volants, which reunite one continent with another, which pursue all the tracks of the sun, overcome annual barriers, and pass from the tropics to the poles on the wings of the wind, unquote. This classical image of mercurial circulation leads in the text immediately to the link between astronomy and commerce. Quote, let us admire the genius of the trader. The same understanding, the text says, that Newton had to calculate the motion of the stars, the trader exerts in tracing the movements of the commercial people that fertilize the earth. Commerce is a science that needs at the same time the knowledge of people and of things, unquote. So my theme is exactly those links
between the specifics of circulatory cosmology and the specification of the knowledge of people and things, which the previous speakers have so brilliantly addressed. There may be various consequences from that pursuit. In the cases, particularly those I'll concentrate on, of Enlightenment agronomy and its colonial enterprises within and beyond the British archipelago, circulation talk defined the powers of those who knew and ran those systems, and those who were often judged incapable of rational knowledge of their world, people whom we might riskily call les vaincus. Furthermore, pursuit of these cosmologies of circulation might, I won't have time to say anything about this, permit a fresh account of the relation between the monetization of the moral economy, precisely as it was analysed by E.P. Thompson, and the transformations of a range of expert knowledges in the overhaul of long-range commercial systems in later 18th century Europe and beyond. But against my prejudice, I'll give you the punchline in case I run out of time. Here's the punchline. It seems to me that the way in which the idiom of circulation was used in the cases I've looked at, agronomy in the Scottish Highlands, to a certain extent in South Asia, certainly in the Australian penal colony, was a weapon, exactly as Samir implied at the end of his talk, it was a weapon to attempt to monopolize knowledge in the hands of a particular elite group and to disqualify very large numbers of others from entering the realm of knowledge. So there's an irony. Regimes of circulation are now used by us to help recognize the wide distribution of savoir, the large number of agents who are making and producing knowledge. But it seems to me that in the first modernity, that language is used for exactly the opposite effect. That's my conjecture. Doesn't mean either side, doesn't mean we're wrong, but it means it would be useful to reflect on what has happened in our own language. An anecdote. In 1787, 4 years after the catastrophic losses of the American War, well, they were catastrophic for the British, they weren't very catastrophic for anybody else, three different coordinated expeditions set out from Britain with the aim of extending, reinforcing, and transforming a new, resuscitated colonial, economic, and military system. The coordinator was Joseph Banks, president of the Royal Society, promoter of the extension of agronomy as a mechanism of global power in the name of a general ideology of commodity circulation and economic improvement. In April 1787, Banks's agent, a Polish botanist called Anton Horver, was sent to Mumbai, to Bombay, and thence to Surat to spy on cotton cultivation in Western India and somehow get precious, high-quality cotton seeds from local growers and bring them to London and send them to the West Indies. The aim was to render the rapidly expanding Lancashire cotton factories independent of skilled Indian growers and traders. A classic example of extraction process designed to make extraction unnecessary. And then in May 1787, so the next month,
A large fleet was sent to New South Wales to establish a new penal colony and to investigate the possibility of experiments on flax and hemp so that British naval vessels could be built in the Pacific and the East India Company's control extended into Eastern Asia. And then at the end of the year, in December of 1787, under the command of the odious William Bligh, the Bounty, that's a ship, was sent to Tahiti to collect samples of breadfruit and bring them to London for experiments and establish the fruit as a reliable food for slaves on West Indian sugar plantations. Each of these three projects show the role that agronomy was supposed to play in solving the colonial predicament of imperial autarky and circulation at long range. They also, this is my point, involve judgments of what we might call the epistemic worth of the others, the people who are not Joseph Banks. According to Banks, there were really two kinds of people, himself and everybody else. For Hove, Indian cotton farmers were understood as uniquely skilled, extraordinarily expert, and as an industrial spy, it was necessary for Banks's agent to learn from them and then expropriate their knowledge and their products and somehow reproduce Indian cotton economy somewhere else. Secondly, in the case of Bligh's, as you may know, catastrophic voyage, notoriously, the illusion of a primeval Tahitian paradise prompted the decisive thought that breadfruit was an effortless crop, needing no skill or any labour in cultivation. Nothing, it was said, needed expropriating. It was, to coin a phrase, a matter of plucking fruit in Eden and growing it in hell. And in the case of the first fleet sent to Australia, the indigenous population was not just ignorant, so the British thought, it was invisible. It was not there. It was precisely because the British thought Australia terra nullius, no one's land, that they so ambitiously proposed a new colony and economic base there. So agronomy suggests ways in which social order and natural knowledge are produced and changed together. End of part one. In its analysis of the circulatory mechanisms of colonial trade, L'Histoire des Deux Indes of Raynal reiterates the conventional formula. Commerce, which arises naturally from agriculture, returns to it by its propensity and by its circulation. That phrase is used explicitly. Thus, Raynal continues, the rivers return to the sea, which has produced them by the exhalation of its waters into vapours and by the fall of those vapours into waters. Nations that are only commercial enjoy, it is true, Raynal insists, the fruits of commerce, but the tree belongs to those people skilled in the cultivation of land. To know nature's agency, agronomists had to manage and transform them and then naturalize them. Farms had to be reframed to make them knowable, and then it was argued that these changes revealed natural principles rather than disrupting them. So the word natural here is absolutely fascinating from a semantic point of view, both in French and in English.
because on the one hand, indigenous traditions were often understood as natural, because they were immemorial, because they were untheorized, but they were unnatural. They didn't obey the laws of nature because they didn't know them. They were erroneous and prejudiced, so it was said. In colonial agronomies, the often vicious entanglement of indigenous custom and reformist managers was absolutely decisive. Think of Richard Grove's work that Sanjay cited on the British colonial projects around colonial botanic gardens. Think of the immense amount of work that's been done on the permanent settlement of Bengal in the 1790s, which was all about the relation between owning land, making it productive, and reassigning, in the name of nature, a circulatory system which, as the name implies, would last forever. We see exactly the same thing both in the penal colony of Australia and in that rather small and windswept North Atlantic archipelago, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, where agronomy was a major, major political concern. It was precisely the agronomic projects of the late Enlightenment and their cosmologies of circulation that began to promote these extremely important models of centrally organized expertise, indigenous ignorance, and peripheral lay consumption. That was the imaginary triangle that was going to be produced. It wasn't produced. It was an imaginary, but a powerful one. The conjuncture of circulatory cosmologies then did not make these models real, but it always sought to realize them in enclosure, in permanent settlement, in new kinds of plowing, in the attack on fallows, and in the displacement of the older form of the moral economy by the cash nexus. Protagonists in England included Banks's closest intellectual ally, Arthur Young, the doyen of English agronomists, who explicitly argued for a complete overhaul both of the circulation of agricultural knowledge and of the praxis of circulation in the field. Young's recipes for the Scottish Highlands and the Irish bogs and the Lakeland fells and the Australian paddocks included convertible husbandry based on what he calls a circulation of wheat, turnips, and fodder crops with no provision whatsoever for fallow or permanent pasture. Traditional forms of expertise were the source of Young's knowledge, for sure, but they were also the cibla, the target against which this system was directed. Now, what about that system? Whence does it come? In a sense, it's deeply classical. It's immemorial in roughly the way, again, that William Jones's ambitions on the crocodile are immemorial. It comes from the fact that large numbers of potentially wealthy English schoolboys spent their early teenage years translating the Georgics. And if you do that, you learn about the agronomy of circulation. You learn, especially the way it was taught in 18th century England, a traditional chemical discourse. The Royal Society itself, in other words, the chief, very anachronistically, scientific organization in London — there wasn't a scientific organization in London, but if there had been, it would have been the Royal Society — had at its center an organization called the Georgical Committee, which was designed to debate and manage experimental agronomy. One of its counselors was Isaac Newton. In 1675, Newton proposes as I've already adumbrated, an entire cosmology of circulation, which, and I quote, describes a vital spirit coagulated in the pores of the earth into some kind of humid matter for the continual uses of nature. Newton goes on, the vast body of the earth may be everywhere to the very center in perpetual working. It will continually condense so much of this spirit as to cause it from above to descend with great speed for a supply. He concludes, nature makes a permanent circulation by this slow ascent of matter from the earth and a descent from above, and so on, and so on. So Newtonian Georgics was circulatory. And what was its politics? Its politics matched, rather precisely, what E.P. Thompson calls the moral economy. The claim was that fertility had been put into the earth and into earth at the creation by God, and that it was there as a form of active spirit. The task of classical agronomy was to identify that spirit and allow it to cultivate. Anyone who extraordinarily profited from or blocked that process of circulation was guilty of blasphemy against God's original purpose. That was the dominant model in England, both, this is my point, within intellectual and political elites, and no doubt, as Thompson and others have shown, within large sections of the agrarian population as well. And that is what is going to be exploited and then challenged and finally undermined by the new model of cash circulation, which is developed in the mid to later 18th century by Jethro Tull, first of all, Oxford-trained lawyer whose works were translated here into French by Henri-Louis Duhamel, very influentially in a large number of volumes, where Duhamel's version, perhaps even more than Tull's original, emphasizes the falsity of peasant tradition, the need to replace an older model of circulation by a new one. Quote, we do not even observe at what time of the sun's course through the heavens we plough, unquote, says Tull in Duhamel de Monceau's version. In other words, this is a project which attacks superstition in the name of the idiocies of plebeian belief, and it's very clear that this then provides a resource for figures like Arthur Young, for his Scottish allies in the Highlands, and for Joseph Banks and his allies in Australia. A whole series of new institutions were founded simultaneously to manage the confiscated Scottish Highland estates after the defeat of the last Jacobite revolt in 1746. These are the resources that Cornwallis and his allies use for the permanent settlement in Bengal from 1793. And these are explicitly the principles that are used to establish the first agrarian settlement in southeastern Australia from 1791-1792. And the linkages, the prosopographic linkages between those three groups of agents are extremely intimate. They basically all come from the same Scottish island. I mean, I won't go into details, but that's more or less what you need to know. Nature's capacities, soil quality, field systems, introduction of plant types on the one hand, and social order, a United Kingdom of Great Britain, a colonial system,
a circulatory global trade network was supposedly going to be defined and produced together. Great, I have 6 minutes. Zippity-doo. The principal institutions which promulgated these views, backed simultaneously by Joseph Banks and Adam Smith, were centered around an organization called the Board of Agriculture. The Board of Agriculture assaulted the older moral economy in the name of a new program of calculation, surveillance, and soil chemistry, of profit and rent maximization, and the identification of the real capital of scientific agronomy with the cultural capital, that's not their phrase, of social and moral advance. We see, as Sanjay evoked at the start of today's meeting, very interestingly comparable developments in the wake of the controversy around the Guerre des Farines in France and the interventions of Quesnay, first of all, through Physiocracy, and then above all, through Turgot and Turgot's representative in chemistry, Antoine Lavoisier. Lavoisier, in his Loire Valley Estates, coordinated the exact survey of the weight of each wheat sheaf, the surveillance of cartloads, the processes of threshing. He made a circulatory system simultaneously of the atmosphere and of agronomy, and the two were supposed to support each other. So his brilliant analysis de la richesse territoriale du Royaume de France is an extraordinarily eloquent example of the way in which what one might call l'économie de la circulation, which he partly borrows from the Physiocracy, but clearly is in dialogue with Turgot, and as I've now realized, Chinese Jesuits, which I didn't know about, right? That's so cool. That model is very comparable to what's happening in Highland Scotland and in Australia at exactly the same time. And one would need, I think, to begin to trace out some of those intellectual, practical, and knowledge connections too. So, in sum, there was a set of linkages between improvident estates, whether they be in La France profonde, in colonized Scotland, in penal Australia, in which there was a combination of something like doctrinaire improvement with social management to define territory which was improvable, and on the other hand, territory which was deemed empty, vacant, terra nullius, in the fearsome phrase of John Locke's philosophy, which has played such a terrible and decisive role in, for example, Australian and, of course, Scottish history. It was, as Hobsbawm taught us, at this moment and in these institutions, notably the Board of Agriculture, that the word in English, feudalism, is invented. Feudalism was introduced by the Board of Agriculture's surveyors in English to describe what was happening on the other side of the Highland Line. And the key word, rental feudalism, begins to be a recipe for the transmutation of that older circulatory model of use into something like a cash nexus. And furthermore, the use of the word colony in writers like Smith must be put back into the context of the link between, I don't know why I'm pointing up towards the entrance of the Collège de France when I think of the Scottish Highlands, but it's up there. Right? If one's thinking of what happens in the English, I mean specifically metropolitan notion of colony at this period, it's massively present in the model of Highland settlement, of the colonia, precisely that older classical notion of settling retired soldiers from the legions in particular estates
in order to bring what was supposed to be vacant land, it wasn't, into cash, nexus, industrial, rental, feudal, and post-feudal production. That is absolutely clear in the vocabulary of what colonies are, and it clearly comes through in Book 4 of Smith's Wealth of Nations. Okay, let me conclude. It was not only livestock, seeds, grandiose agricultural schemes which travel between the colonies and provinces and are judged in the metropole. In the catastrophic period, Europe-wide at least, after 1791, of unemployment and high food prices and prosecution and what I guess we should now call the Second World War, presumably since the First World War ended in 1763, the Second World War began in 1794. More radical experiments began to be proposed, again using the notion of circulation to change the empire of agronomy. Radical pastoralists set up collaborative schemes to take land into production. They were present in force in European cities. They were judged by magistrates. Their demands involved, again, a reorganization of the social order in terms of the true principles of nature. In the English case, they were either executed or sent to Australia. Good choice. As the working class radical's greatest historian, Edward Thompson, has put it, land always carries associations of status, security, and rights more profound than the value of its crop. If you follow the language of circulation and the practices of circulation to and from Australia, one begins to see, this has been my argument, how an entire politics of science and nature flows from that profound insight. Final anecdote. And there's a rude word in this anecdote. So if you're sensitive, get ready, okay? Because it's Australian, that's all. Watkin Tench, my hero, was a captain of Marines in the new colony in Australia between 1788 and 1791. He helped manage an outfit called Experiment Farm, which was run by freed convicts who had been setting up radical circulatory schemes back in Britain. Tench was a keen reader of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he recorded his observations of the indigenous populations in France, in Australia, and in London. Quote, whether plodding in London, reeking with human blood in Paris, or wandering amidst the solitary wilds of New South Wales, man is always, sorry about the sexist language, man is always an object of interest, curiosity, and reflection, unquote. In April of 1791, Tench joined an expedition into the west. So he was going from Sydney towards a very high range of mountains called the Blue Mountains, which are about 30 kilometers west of the coast and for a very long time blocked white expansion from the coastal strip into the Australian interior. The aim was to locate cultivable lands along the rivers that somehow flowed mysteriously from these mountains. Tench wrote a whole essay using the cosmology of circulation to explain why these rivers and these mountains meant that there must be, on the other side of the mountains, huge cultivable pastures. He was wrong about that, but doesn't mind for the moment. Their guides, two of the men in their party, were Eora, Aborigines from the Australian coast, expert fishermen, expert hunters. Their names were Colby and Baladery. The Eora were, of course, lightly laden and much amused by the whites' sufferings. They refused, Tench says, to draw water or cut wood, unquote. According to Tench, this was not the only difference. Unlike the English, the Eora simply could not see the point of this journey. Quote, to convey to their understandings the intention of our journey was impossible, because perhaps no words can unfold to a person like that the motives of curiosity which induce men to encounter labour and fatigue and pain when they might remain in repose at home with a sufficiency of food, unquote. And it seems to me that our puzzlement remains. We don't yet have a good account with which we could satisfy the Eora, with which we could answer Colby and Balladary. Why were these whites doing this? I've offered up a certain kind of conjecture, which is focused on a reflexive use of circulatory models and their transmutation. But the Eora had a much simpler explanation. The British, they said to each other, eat shit. Thank you.